Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy New Year to you all. I hope you rang it in with family and friends and fizzy drinks and goofy glasses with lots of joy and laughter. And if you made it all the way till midnight, congratulations, you did better than I did. We're so glad that you are with us in 2025 for what is promising to be a year filled with news that is going to directly impact children. And we want to equip you to be at the forefront of defending them. We are going to kick off our episode today with a verse that I was reading with my 15-year-old. We have just started the book of Philippians, and chapter one is rich. And I'll tell you what, if I have a 2025 theme verse, it is probably what Paul wrote in the opening of this incredible letter to the church at Philippi. And it is, to live is Christ, to die is gain. I know, you've heard it forever, so have I. But there was something about reading it with my 15-year-old where I said, what on earth does that mean? And he goes, I guess that if I'm living, everything that I'm doing is going to be for Christ. And I don't know, something about hearing those words come out of your 15-year-old's mouth makes you go, yes, baby. And throw yourself into it and dedicate it forever. And I said, but what do you think this to die is gain means? And he said, I don't know. Does that mean that Christ becomes even more real when we're not on this earth? I just swooned. I'll tell you what, there is something about hearing the truths of God come out of the mouths of your kids. If they're three and they're just reciting a Bible verse, or if they're 15 and they're trying to put into their own words some of the deepest truths of the Christian faith, there is sweetness there. So I just want to commend you as you look ahead to 2025 to sow those spiritual seeds in your kids. And then wait and watch as you get to reap a spiritual harvest as they grow. We're going to kick off 2025 looking at some of the big highlights, the big news items that impacted children in the previous year. And to help me, as always, I have my executive director, Josh Wood, here. Josh, hope you had a wonderful new year. And I know you've got big plans for 2025 because I'm your boss and you are going to do great things in 2025. Josh is one of the reasons why Them Before Us is taking the globe by storm, baby. And so Josh has also got a good head on his shoulders and he is going to help us recap some of the big headlines that really impacted kids in 2024.
Well, I loved your story about your son talking through that verse. I have come to believe that that verse is, if Them Before Us had a life verse, it would be that one. I think we talk about adults doing hard things all the time and putting them before us. And it's always important that we're not calling adults everywhere to some vow of poverty where everything they do is to be misery and suffering. We do ask people to take on voluntarily that burden on behalf of children because we believe it to be right and we believe it to be good. That when we do those things, God does reward us with life. And it does often look like, sometimes, not to be dramatic, but it looks like death sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sacrificing ourselves and our desires, and sometimes very good desires, the desires to create children, the desires to build a big family, can run smack dab into realities we never thought we'd have to face. And I do think we call, and we don't even do it, God calls everyone, all parents, all adults, to put them before us, because he knows it is the pathway to life abundant, even when we can't see that path, when it doesn't seem clear. And so I love that verse. I love that it's, you know, happening in a new year. And when we can instill that in our children, that this might seem counterintuitive. In fact, it is the paradox of the gospel, but God's way is going to be better than your way. So trust it and lean into it. Mm-hmm. Now, We'll switch gears into this first story, which is the Alabama IVF ruling. And I would say that nothing maybe caught me off guard more in 2024 than this ruling. Who thought that IVF would become a centerpiece of a presidential campaign? I mean, if I took a poll 5 years ago, I don't think anyone would even know what it meant. It certainly has risen in prominence as more people use it, but popular media, or if you've never struggled with infertility, you don't really have any reason to know anything about it. But this ruling said no matter whether a life is a day old or 2 days old inside the womb or now outside the womb, it is a life. What was striking about this was not even the recognition of that truth from an Alabama Supreme Court. It was the response from the fertility clinics. They immediately said, if my business model must recognize and be held accountable and liable for every embryo, and it's going to now be considered life to the point where I could be sued if something happens to this life, well, then I don't know how I could do my model anymore. I don't know how I could continue to be a fertility clinic. And I think, take your thought on this, Katie, when someone tells you that their business model is now out defunct because it cannot end the embryonic life within their walls, that feels like they're telling on themselves.
Oh, 100%. And you know, like a lot of us look back on Roe versus Wade as the greatest ruling against children, and it probably was. And then we look at Dobbs, which overruled Roe versus Wade, and we say that was the best ruling in terms of in favor of life. But it actually wasn't as good as what the Supreme Court of Alabama did, because Dobbs just said, this goes back to the states, it's not a settled matter. The Alabama ruling said, these are kids and they deserve to be protected. And we actually can punish somebody if they're responsible for the death of an innocent child. It really was a distinction of personhood on unborn children. And like you said, the fertility world went berserk. You know, they said, we're not going to be able to conduct business in Alabama. And everything came to a grinding halt. And so this is an area where we at Them Before Us spend a lot of time doing education, a lot of time highlighting the fact that big fertility is responsible for the death of more embryonic life every year than Planned Parenthood, that IVF is a matter of child protection, and that, yes, it is a pathway for some people to have children who are experiencing infertility, but those adult longings cannot come at the expense of the victimization of children. So that was a big story that had clear ripple effects all the way down in terms of both Republican and Democrat efforts to try to quote unquote protect IVF. And then obviously, you know, President Trump was making promises, calling himself the grandfather of IVF or the father of IVF or whatever it is. And so this is an area where Christians, we need to be very clear about who we are protecting and what their rights are. And then we need to go transform culture and not let culture transform us.
Absolutely. And if you need, go to thembeforeus.com, click Fast Facts. You will find everything you need to know. If you're like, well, Katie, why is IVF bad? I thought we were for creating babies. Just go to Fast Facts, go to our website, do some research on your own. All right, next story is about Pornhub. If you don't know, I was shocked to find that I believe the latest statistic was that 1 in 3 Google searches is for pornography. 1 in 3. Let me say that again. For every 3 searches, 1 person is looking at porn. That is unbelievable. 1 in 4 sites on the internet are porn sites. This is wild. It is a massive, massive industry, with as much as 30% of the women involved being trafficked persons. Horrific. Right? Horrific. But this particular case brought in Texas against Pornhub, one of the largest suppliers of pornography on the internet. We certainly abhor pornography. We think it's damaging our whole community, our nation, people. I think it exploits women. But we know our mission is specific to kids. We know that God's called us specifically to that thing. And so when it comes to child defense, Texas brought a law that was just right down the middle for us. Do you want to explain it?
Yeah, it was something that's been tried in a couple other states. But basically, Texas insisted that there needed to be age verification laws. You know, there's ways that we can regulate users on the internet for things like internet gaming. You've got to prove that you're 18 years old if you want to enter some kind of gambling website. We don't have those kinds of protections for porn, even though I would say demonstrably, porn is more harmful, especially to children. And so Texas said, look, you're going to have to do age verification. Pornhub said, well, forget that. We're going to leave then, right? And then there was a case brought against Texas saying this is a violation of our free speech, right? If you're going to curb any kind of access that we have by just imposing us to show some ID or prove our age, then we're out. Okay. And so there was this case that was brought against it, and it is now, heading to the Texas courts. And it is something that Them Before Us has gotten involved with. There are situations for Supreme Courts and lower appellate courts where you're able to submit something called an amicus brief. That is simply a friend of the court brief. Anybody can file it, but it's really saying, hey, we have some information that we think you, the justices, should consider here. And so Them Before Us submitted a brief that explicitly laid out how damaging porn exposure is to kids. Definitely in terms of the connection between porn consumption and their own disordered sexual choices later on. About 85% of porn also includes some level of violence towards women. Therefore, it is no surprise that children, especially boys who consume porn, are more likely to act out violently when they're in their own romantic relationships. But even if there no violence occurs, it is damaging for children to be exposed to pornography, and it is very often addictive. You could argue that porn is the most widely available drug in the country, and it has long-term effects on children's development and their own self-perception. So this was a case that we got in on with both feet. We addressed pornography and specifically the importance of age verification laws in our book that came out last September, Pro-Child Politics. We've got a chapter on porn. So if you want more information about porn and why this actually is a matter of justice for children, you can purchase Pro-Child Politics and read all about that.
It's awesome. I was so proud of our team for putting together that brief, and it's such an important issue and absolutely something the state should have an interest in protecting kids from. All right. Next story is in April, the Biden administration unveiled this past April, 2024, sweeping changes to rewrite Title IX to include gender identity as a form of sex discrimination, which we all know what that veiled, language was for. It was to ignore biological reality and absolutely threaten privacy and safety of girls, student athletes, free speech of students. Do you want to take that one?
Well, it absolutely unleashed an eruption of conservative attorneys generals across the country that said, not in our state. Absolutely not. You are actually doing the exact opposite of what Title IX was erected to protect. Title IX exists so that girls are going to be able to have scholarships, sports teams of their own, fair play, protection. And it is now turned into a vehicle of the genuine patriarchy. I mean, a tool that was supposed to advance and protect the rights of women and girls is now a tool for some men and boys to take advantage of those spots on the sports teams or those scholarships. And so it is an absolute perversion of what Title IX was established to protect, and that is the rights of girls, specifically in college and in sports. And so there was an awful lot of pushback that took place rightly on behalf of that. And I wouldn't doubt if the Title IX changes that the Biden administration in some ways illegitimately forced on the states played a role in the Biden-Harris loss in the last election. Like, people just are not having it. I think, the transgender issue in general was very prominent in the minds of Americans. I mean, I've seen some exit polls. This is something that normal Americans can understand. Maybe they don't understand tax policy. Maybe they're not sure about how much of a threat China is, but they know that boys and girls are different. And they don't think that little boys should be transitioned into little girls. And they believe that their daughters should be able to have a spot on the track team and should not lose it to a boy who has gone through male puberty. And even though he was number 57 on the boys' track team, suddenly catapults to number one on the girls' track team. It was enough for the ordinary American people to say, that is too far, and we're looking for a change. We're going to be back in just a moment with our next segment, talking a little more about trending news and what you can expect in the upcoming year. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to our first show of 2025. We're so glad that you're with us for Them Before Us Radio, where what we hope to do is train you to think about everything happening in the world through the lens of what if we put kids first. So we brought you along with a little recap of 2024, but instead, we'd also like to talk with you about some of the really bad bills that came up and they either passed or they got shot down, but things we want you to be aware of because there are so many legislative attempts to strip children of their rights, and a lot of these aren't going away. Right. We're going to see more and more of that, some doubling down in 2025 and probably a reintroduction of a couple of the bills that didn't quite make it over the finish line. So I've got my executive director, Josh Wood, here to go through some of the bad legislation that we had to fight back against in 2024. So we'll start with the misnamed Family Protection Act in Michigan that in essence legalized commercial surrogacy and made a bunch of other changes to their family law. Now, what you notice in matters of marriage and family when it comes to legislation is that the bill usually does the exact opposite of what the name might communicate. So in this case, the Family Protection Act, it doesn't protect families when you're talking about children's fundamental right, their bond, their claim to their own parents. It actually is the Family Destruction Act. But we see that regularly. We'll see the Uniform Parentage Act, which supposedly uniformly assigns parenthood to adults that have acquired children through reproductive technologies. From the child's perspective, it's more accurately the Uniform, the Destruction of Parentage Act. You're destroying children's claim to their own parents. So Michigan is an example of doing it wrong. Josh, do you want to tell us about some of the other bills that were fought back against by our organization personally in 2024?
Yeah, let's pause for those that may not follow family law as close as we do. These acts kind of hinged on one particular concept I'd love for you to explain. And it's this change away from what we would call, you know, the natural family, where biology determines children and their relationship to their parents, towards something very different called intent-based parenting. So, I mean, that is what is getting redefined in so many of these acts. Katie, do you mind just explaining why is it such a big deal that we are moving from you created the child, you have a right to the child, to now something very different?
Well, the idea that you need to assign parents to a child is laughable if you look throughout family history, you know, the history of the world and most every culture throughout the ages. It was pretty much understood that if you gave birth to a child, that was your baby. And then we had a presumption that if you were married to the mother of that child, that was your baby. So that has been the case in every culture throughout history, that there is a natural presumption that babies and parents go together. And it is actually a pre-political recognition. It's not something that the state recognizes or awards. It's something, I should say, it's not something the state gives and awards. It's something that is simply recognized. It's a pre-political mm-hmm. reality recognized by the state. And like all natural rights, it's not given by the government. It should be protected by the government. And so there's two legitimate pathways to establishing parenthood. Number one is a biological connection or a genetic connection. This is what has been recognized throughout every country of the world. Mm-hmm. It's what's mm-hmm. recognized in the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child that says that children have a right to be known and loved by the two people, both parents who brought them into existence. The other legitimate pathway for recognizing parenthood is adoption. We recognize that in some cases where there has been a family bond that is broken and the child needs to have that family situation redeemed and restored, adoption is the proper pathway to do that, where adults are going to go through extensive screening and vetting so that they can prove that they will actually be the kind of home that this child deserves. So those are the ways that we have typically recognized parenthood throughout our laws, throughout our different family law statutes. But what's happened, especially since Obergefell, especially since we've legalized gay marriage, is we've now introduced a new pathway for parenthood. It's not biologically based, and it's not through the pathway of extreme vetting that adoptive parents go through. It is the idea of, I intend to parent this child, therefore give me the baby, without any kind of screening or vetting, oftentimes without any kind of genetic connection. That is a big problem for children, because unrelated adults, even if they intend to parent, even if they're in a romantic relationship with the child's other parent, don't provide the same level of protection, investment, and connection that a child's own biological parents do. So whenever we are looking at these shifts in parenthood law, what we're actually talking about is putting children in inherently risky situations where they also are likely to suffer the identity struggles of growing up without one or both of their biological parents.
But just to pause on adoption, even within adoption, adoption recognizes that it has to overcome the rights of the parents who created the child. So there is even a process where if a child is given up for adoption or a child is placed into state custody, there's a process in which they're recognizing, you know, the child must be in danger. The child must be, you know, the parents have to go through a process to relinquish these rights. But it's almost acknowledging the premise here that there is, that this child does have parents. And in order for this child to be adopted by someone else, we have to, those rights have to either be relinquished, be done away with, you know, however you want to phrase that. But it does seem to me like both of those pathways do have built into them a recognition that the state is just acknowledging, recognizing that this child has a mother and a father. Whereas intent-based, on the other hand, almost puts the state in this position of adjudication where, okay, well, yeah, biology aside, this child has come into the world. Now let me decide. You all intend, you are the parents now, and the state is putting itself in this very powerful position. That seems like a big problem, and it strikes at the core of these parentage acts, because the more the state has to be involved, the more the state's going to be the one kind of divvying out children into whatever arrangement they want. That seems like a very dangerous place for us to put, again, a government.
Right. Typically, when children are born, it's a presumption that they are connected to the two people who gave them life, especially their mother. That is a reasonable presumption, and that's why it's recognized throughout common law going far, far back, even before the founding of the United States. This is just something that is assumed. And like you said, the validation for that assumption can be seen in adoption law, where it is very difficult to detach children from their parents if you want to remove them from the home. And then it's difficult to reattach them to biological strangers for good reason. For good reason. And so the intent-based parenthood very casually detaches children from one or both genetic parents and very casually reattaches them to biological strangers. And so what we're seeing is really the upending of, you know, traditions within law and culture and within society, that parents and children go together. This is not something where the government should be greatly involved unless there is a significant breakdown. But in the name of non-discrimination, obviously so that we can make sure that adults get the quote unquote equality that they deserve in the family redefinition world, it requires we strip children of their rights and very often place them in situations where they are less likely to thrive.
So that's the reason we're spending so much time on this is this legislation in Michigan, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, California, struck at the heart of this basic truth that children come from a mom and a dad, and the state needs to recognize that, and we go from there. So in Michigan, we talked about that legalizing surrogacy. Well, surrogacy helps to facilitate third parties to be involved so that children are then cut and pasted into other arrangements. Minnesota considered a similar surrogacy bill. Massachusetts, probably one of the worst examples, one of the worst bills that we fought against this year. It not only did really a horrendous thing around genetic surrogacy, which Katie, I'd love for you to explain why that's a significant escalation, but it also allowed for polyparenting, where multiple individuals, two moms, one dad, three dads, one mom, can all be listed on a birth certificate and all be acting as parents, not the two people that are naturally the parent who created the child. But that genetic surrogacy was something we got very involved in. And Katie, talk about why that's just, again, my words, just horrendous.
Yeah, Patience Sunny, our engagement director, sort of broke the story on the extreme provisions in this bill. And then it was taken up by several other publications. But typically there are some guardrails, even around big fertility, which operates virtually regulation-free. And one of them is that you cannot sell your own genetic child. And even though that happens in what is known as traditional surrogacy, that it would then happen post-IVF and outside of the guardrails of having a contract in place first. There was a lot of different ways that this bill really did cross so much further into the lane of obvious baby selling. And that's really what was taking place, where you could create a child that is 100% biologically related to the mother, and then she could simply hand it over to somebody who paid her money for it. So there's a lot of blurring of the lines anyway between big fertility and baby selling, but this bill really made those lines a lot more opaque than they were before. And it's a huge, huge risk. And of course, as always, with the introduction of intent-based parenthood in conjunction with this, they threw the door open for polyparenting. And really, it's just any adult that wants to say, this kid belongs to me, this version of the Parentage Act in Massachusetts simply makes children accessories, you know, designer commodities that can be acquired by whatever adult wants them, has paid for them in any kind of arrangement, in any number of adults in the household. So it really is one of the most extreme Parentage Acts, kind of family overhauls that we have seen, driven largely by big fertility.
Well, and really proud of our team and specifically patients for leading the way on this. But we did push this into the national news, got this articles written, got on a couple of national news shows to talk about it, or a couple of shows that go, you know, all over the country. And now have at least, again, we it did pass in Massachusetts, but have begun the process of waking other states up to some of this so that people are prepared with understanding how little shifts in language, like removing mother and father from bills, can really have just an unbelievable impact. But I want to move on. That's an important one because, like I said, five or six bills came across all on that one idea. But there have been others, some that we cover pretty extensively in Pro-Child Politics, one specifically, the policy change around immigration that ultimately began to encourage children to be sent alone or to be sent with these cartel members to be delivered across the border because I think in the vein of misplaced compassion, the Biden administration chose not to enforce certain rules and laws, not to send people back, and specifically if someone came by themselves, to take in that child and to try to place them with a sponsor. But, you know, as I've said before, the U.S. government is not equipped to be everybody's mother and father. And when we try to take responsibility for 300,000 children coming alone into our country, it has disturbing consequences.
Yeah, the unaccompanied minor problem really began after a critical Supreme Court ruling back in 2009. Then we started to see the spike in unaccompanied minors coming across the border in 2010, and then it escalated over the next couple of years. But it really took on a dramatic increase when Biden-Harris took office. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that there was much less vetting. There was much less scrutiny of the people that were taking the children once they got to the border. And you probably remember the big kerfuffle about the kids in cages when Trump was in office back in his first term, where there is a requirement, like there should be a requirement to hold those children for a while and figure out, where are their parents? Can we reunite them? Are they actually going to go to a relative or a sponsor that the children genuinely know? Like, they would ask questions if there was a adult that was coming across with the child. They would say, you know, do you know this person? They would evaluate, is the child nervous about traveling with them? Is it very clear that they have a parental relationship with them, or has this child maybe been drugged so that they are in a place where they're not able to respond and speak up for how they're being treated and where they're going? A lot of that went out the window, unfortunately, when Biden-Harris came in. They didn't like the optics of kids in cages, around which Trump received so much blowback. And so instead of having that terrible visual aid that would work against their policies, what they did is very, very casually just handed these kids off, not from their parents, but from the cartels that brought them across the border directly into the hands of supposed sponsors that very often the kids never knew and for whom they were not able to track those kids down later. So we confirmed have 30,000 children that have received notices to reappear in court that have not reappeared, and then upward of 300,000 who were handed off to these unvetted sponsors. And there's a very high chance that hundreds of thousands of children have been trafficked across our border and are now in situations of forced labor or sex trafficking. It's absolutely abysmal. And Laura Reese, who wrote our immigration chapter for Pro-Child Politics, takes a deep dive into this very issue.
I think the thing I'm going to draw a straight line between all of what we've talked about with the five or six bad bills and this one is adults in the way of misplaced compassion, whether it's to create children for two men or two women, or, you know, or it's to give a child a better opportunity coming from a different country. It's all this misplaced compassion that really the child is going to have to pay the price for. And they didn't want the optics of the cages. They didn't want the optics of detention. So they moved to just letting them go into the country. Again, the child can't advocate for themselves, never gets a chance to speak up in these situations. And again, it's adults making the decision and overriding what's best for the kids. Man, we need to be, again, we need to tell the truth. These are trade-offs. They're hard decisions. But man, we could have done so much better, specifically with that immigration piece.
There's always trade-offs, right, in situations where it's family creation, family structure, immigration, really every political issue that we highlight, especially in pro-child politics, someone's going to have to do the hard thing. But at Them Before Us, we just think it should be the adults and not the child, because it's when it's the child, we very often put their lives, their safety, and their future at risk. Thanks for being with us. We're going to be back in just a second with answers to your questions.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
We want to answer some of the questions that you have moving into this brand new, maybe clean slate of a year. So to help field some of the questions that you have sent in over the last week, we have our training director, Jen Friesen. Happy New Year to you, Jen. Thanks for joining us again.
Happy New Year 2025. So exciting. So just a few interesting things happening in the next few days, right? Guess we'll see how it all goes. This is a question. I have a great question that I'm sure you and I have never thought about living in the Seattle area in the only state in the union that went more blue in the election than, you know, no one else. I think even California trended red, but Washington. So the question is, yeah.
It can't be because of the massive amount of mail-in ballots now, could it? I don't know what it could be.
Whoa, conspiracy theory. Yeah, who knows? Or California transplants escaping theirs. Right. All the California people came up here and all of our conservatives left to other states. But that's to the question. It says, is it better to stay in blue states that are legalizing and pushing things we disagree with to fight them, I guess? Or should we be voting with our feet and move to states that we're more in alignment with?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a question that everybody in Seattle has asked themselves at some point. Maybe not what is best for the state, but what is best for me? Is it time for me to get out of here? I mean, honestly, even the gay couple at the end of my street put their house up for sale 2 years ago, and they're like, we can't handle it here anymore. We're moving to Central Washington. I mean, like, even the liberals are like, I can't take it. So everybody in Seattle has asked this question, so much so that when I meet somebody in from Idaho who's like in Post Falls or in Coeur d'Alene or in Boise, I'm like, oh, you're from Idaho? They're like, yeah. And I'm like, oh, how's my church doing over there? Because so many people, I mean, like, it feels like half of my church has just moved right over the border to Idaho because they've said, I can't handle it in this blue state. I'm getting out of here. So I've actually had this conversation with so many people that I have like a little metric that you can use to figure out whether or not you should move. So the first metric is that as Christians, we do not run from things. We don't. We can run to things. Maybe God is calling you to something, but we do not run from anything. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, especially during the pandemic, really studying Jeremiah in depth, because I feel like we're not in the place where we're in Jerusalem, where there's sort of a Christian kind of Judeo-Christian majority. We're in Babylon. We're the remnant. Like, we are the people that are now the fringe, the outlier. And I think that Jeremiah really speaks to those people, the people that are being conquered, right? The people that are being dragged off into captivity. Like, that actually really applies pretty closely to people that are living in Seattle. And what I do see from a lot of people is saying, I'm going to go to Tennessee. I'll be safe there. I'm going to move to Coeur d'Alene. They won't find me. And that's very much the mentality of the people of Israel who said, oh, the Babylonians are coming. I'm going to flee to Egypt because sword, pestilence, and famine are not going to be able to find me there. And God said, don't think that you're going to find salvation in Egypt. If you flee to Egypt, sword, pestilence, and famine are going to find you to where you have fled. So first we need to like correct this mentality in our mind that salvation can be found in red states. They can't. Salvation is found in the Lord. And you need to do what he wants you to do. Maybe it is to move someplace for the sake of providing for your family or protecting your family. That's fine. But it can't just be to flee because you are afraid. Christians, you've got a little something in you that is greater than what is in the world, than he who is in the world. And so we need to have the conquering mindset and the mindset not to fear. So that's number one. Number two, I would say, you do need to recognize that your primary allegiance and your primary job is to your own children, right? And that if there are forces that are coming for your child and you do not see a way out to protect them, especially in those early years and the grammar phases, you know, 0 to 10 in the elementary school years, when I really think that it is a parental duty to shelter your children from the distortions of the world. Maybe you can't homeschool. Maybe there's no private school option where you are, and you really do feel like you need to move for the sake of your child, then you need to listen to the Lord about that. I know people that had children who were struggling with gender confusion. They could not take their child to a therapist here. The therapist would need to affirm their gender identity if they went to Children's Hospital. Children's Hospital could kidnap them and then refuse to give them back if the parents didn't consent to transgender treatments. And they're like, bye. We're going to Utah. And so like sometimes you have to make those kinds of decisions to protect your child. But then third, I would say that Christians are called to be a preserving agent in the culture. That's what it means to be salt and light. And I'll tell you, there's high, high friction living in a place that promulgates values that are diametrically opposed to what you believe and to biblical values. There is also quite a lot of benefit that can come from it, both in terms of the purification of your faith, the sifting aspect that will strip you of the non-essentials and help you study, double down, and feast upon the essentials. And then you get very serious about training your children. And your children will learn to fight back against the forces of the enemy, which isn't flesh and blood, but sometimes comes in the form of flesh and blood. So I just think it's something to think about. I think that's fine. Many of the Christians have left, but there's still kids in this state that need to be protected, and they're not going to be protected if all of the voters and all of the different cultural leaders and all of the different employees never, never even give them an option of something other than secular progressivism. Jen, you are also here in this deep blue state. Have you ever thought about leaving, and what were the considerations that you worked through?
My thought of that is, to where would I go when you're single and your family's here? And then I love my church community. And I think to the point of what you're saying, once you find solid Christian community here, I do think there's a different breed of Christian in places that are more challenging. And I don't want to pretend we're in like Nazi Germany or anything, but it's interesting to me. Why didn't Christians just bail in Germany? Why didn't they just leave in Soviet Russia? There were people who decided to stay because they knew that's what God was calling them to do. And there were probably some that were called to leave. And I do think there's a different, when I think of the folks who are Christians in North Korea, granted, they don't have the option of leaving, probably overwhelmingly, but there is something different about people who are Christians when there is not only no benefit, but incredible hardship against you. I just think God is using those people, and I'm inspired just in my own much less dramatic, not as scary, not as dangerous context. we face a little social disagreement here and there. You know, it's not as terrible, of course, as these other things. But is it making me a saltier Christian? Is it making me, is it hardening my spine? I think so. And I haven't felt called to leave or really had opportunity that's even been attractive to me to leave. So I think, yeah, what you're saying is great. Our faithfulness, we should be faithful no matter where we are, willing to leave, willing to stay, whatever God's asking us to do, for sure.
Yeah. I know most of my friends who have decided to leave have done it not because of the taxation, even though that's horrible, not because of the drug crisis and the homelessness, even though that's very frustrating and challenging. They've done it because they're like, I can't let my kids be around this. And I totally get that. But also, I know the Christians who have stayed, and yes, some children stray, but I will tell you, I am surrounded by Christian parents who are raising faithful kids who know how to articulate their worldview, stand up and push back. We captured a lot of the techniques for how to pass that down in our second book, Raising Conservative Kids in a Woke City, that Stacey Manning and I co-authored, and lots of tips about if you are, no matter where you live, because you know you think you're going to go to Idaho and it's not going to find you there. It totally is. You think you're going to homeschool your kids and you're going to protect them from the woke nonsense? No, their friends have pronouns in their bios too. So you're going to have to equip your kids regardless of where you live. It is, does obviously more urgent if you're in a blue state or your kids are in public school. So that just means you have to be more serious about training, and raising conservative kids in a woke city is a great place to start.
Yeah, well said. Okay, next question. Our 13-year-old adopted daughter is very interested in her birth family, but we know that they aren't safe and healthy people. Is there any way to help facilitate relationships, or at least the knowledge, maybe the knowledge about their family, without opening her up to more hurt and pain?
Oh my gosh, you've got to be so wise about this, because so at minimum, honest answers to honest questions. Okay, she has honest answers. Why did my parents relinquish me? Who is my father? Do I have similarities? Do I have siblings? Do my grandparents know that I exist? And as much as possible, honest answers to honest questions. Now, the challenge that you are going to face here is you don't want to, you want to be honest, but you also don't want to unnecessarily degrade the impression that she has of her first family. So some of it you may not have answers to. And in that sense, you want to cast her birth family in the most positive light possible without being dishonest. So, we've had to do that with our adopted son. He's had some questions. We don't have answers. So we recount what we call kind of hopeful fiction in terms of, I'm sure that they really wanted to make sure that you were developing well in utero because you were at a really healthy birth weight. So obviously your mom really cared for you, you know, while you were in her tummy, kind of things. Now, I don't necessarily know if that's true, but I am going to give him an explanation that aligns with the facts and paints his first family in a very positive light. Your other big challenge is if you know that they're unhealthy, if you know that it would not be in your child's best interest, that is where you do need to put up some appropriate limits, at least until she's 18. And you can decide how honest you want to be about, you know what, they're not really in a place to connect with right now, especially alone. Maybe we could invite them to one of your birthday parties and they can be here with us, with me while I'm here. Maybe they're in a place where there shouldn't be any contact at all and you'll have to be a little more honest. Honey, I'm so sorry. Hopefully there'll be a time when we can all get together and meet them when you're older. But unfortunately right now, it's not a safe situation. So obviously there's a lot of things that I don't know in terms of what you're facing and that's those specific questions, but you need to do as much as possible to be honest about her situation. Keep the door open as much as you can do without being dishonest. Paint them in an honorable light. Open the door to as much relationship as possible, but you are her parents and protection has got to be at the top of your list.
I wonder too, if it might be helpful at all for, so this is 13-year-old girl in the scenario, but you know, if you say, in the scenario where it's not safe or feasible for them to have any kind of physical connection or who knows, to encourage, let's write them a letter about that memory or that thing you want to share or those questions you want to ask. And maybe we don't have a place to send it right now. But I just think of some ways that you can say those are great things to express and you should totally be able to ask them those questions or tell them what you want to tell them. And maybe you can't right now, but let's write it out. or journal it or think about it or record a video that you can save. I just think at least it's acknowledging that the kid has something they want to be able to express and they don't know exactly how, and maybe there's not a person to receive it yet. But that could also be kind of cool. Let's say at 18, that first family is in more of a space to have a connection. Now this child has, you know, here's some memories and things that I've collected over the years that I wanted you to know and you couldn't, but you get to know them now.
Well, the other thing I love about that is what you're saying is you can totally come to me about this and I will help you, right? Like you are training the child to go, even if my mom can't do everything that I'm looking for, she's totally open to this. She wants to help me. She's thinking creatively about this. I am rewarded with intimacy, rewarded with answers, rewarded with possible pathways forward, even if it's not everything that I want, when I disclose how I feel to her. And that is always a parental win.
That's good. This would be, oh gosh, I'm gonna have to edit. Shoot. I don't think we have time to do the whole third question.
What is it?
Well, this was like, I'm acknowledging our choices in our marriage have led us to a breaking point. Now I'm seeing how devastated getting married would be for our kids. How can I win back my wife? Save our marriage.
We can try to do it tight.
Okay.
Okay. So I paused that. I'm going to unpause. And hopefully once you cut all of this out, mm-hmm. you'll only cut like another 5 seconds because I cut it off 5 seconds later. So,
okay. This has been about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Final question quickly. Someone said, I'm acknowledging my choices in our marriage have led us to a breaking point, but now I see how devastating getting divorced would be for our kids. How can I best win back my wife and save it?
Okay. Congratulations. You've done the hardest part. You have been honest. And that is something that, I mean, we've worked with a lot of couples who have been in a lot of challenging situations. And oftentimes the barrier to any kind of recovery is the lack of ability to really do some self-reflection, but you have done it. So in my opinion, the hardest part is over. Now I would say what you need to do is get more people in on this project of reconciliation. Yes, counselors, maybe therapists, certainly mentors, maybe mediators, and absolutely accountability partners, because there are going to be some things in your life where you're going to say, these have been patterns or sticking points with me. Part of what I am going to do differently is include other people so I genuinely can start making progress. And I will tell you what, when your wife sees you changing, it is going to give her hope, because right now she probably doesn't have hope. She's probably seen the pattern repeated over and over and thinks, what's the point? Nothing ever changes. We've been doing this for 8 years or whatever it is. You start changing through the power of the word of God inside you, godly mentors with you, genuine hard work of therapy, and reform. And I'll tell you what, if you devote yourself to your wife and children and she sees the change in you, you are going to be over the greatest hurdle and probably on towards mending your marriage. Great question. I'm going to pray for you. I desperately want your children to see Christ and his bride reflected in your relationship with your wife.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.